Good morning, and welcome to Family Life. Your hosts, Selena Muhammad and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent, Arad Speed. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful. I greet our guests and the listening audience in the peace of Assalamu Alaikum. This week's discussion, Family Life, we have Mr. Hassan Abdullah Esquire. Mr. Abdullah completed his JD degree at Seton Hall University of Law. He completed his bachelor's degree at Bucknell University, Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. He is a solo practitioner. Primary practice as a criminal trial attorney, additional practice in civil law, real estate, personal injury, and federal criminal and civil practice. Lead defense counsel in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing case. Mr. Abdullah is the assistant prosecutor represented in the state of New Jersey in all stages of criminal litigation, including investigation, search warrant approval, grand jury hearings, plea conference, bail, and pretrial hearings, motion, practice, and jury trials. Significant trial experience is over 100 jury trials, including homicides, drug prosecutions, and sexual assaults. Additionally, assignments include juvenile court, appellate division, trial court, and narcotic unit. Mr. Abdullah's professional affiliations include Court TV, legal commentator, and these affiliations to the listening audience begin in the early 90s and we're ending in the mid 2000s. WBAI, radio legal commentator, KISS FM radio social legal commentator, Street Soldiers, Attorney Ethics Fee Arbitration, INNS of Port Essex County, WBAI radio co-host, Tahia. And this is from 1997 to present. Islamic arbitration. Majlis Ashura of New Jersey. Supreme Court Special Committee on Recordation of Custodial Interrogation. INNS of Court. Union County. Union County Advisory Committee. And that's from 2006 to current. Union Bar. Union County Bar Association Criminal Law Committee, Board President, Federal Islam of Elizabeth Incorporated, currently. Inducted into the Bucknell University Hall of Fame in 2005 and inducted into the City of Elizabeth Hall of Fame 2008. Hassan, welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Family Life.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Let's begin with, in his book, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, Bill Kunstler noted that the four main defendants in the World Trade Center bombing trial, Ahmad Ajad, Nidal Ayad, Muhammad Salameh, and Muhammad Abu Halima were shortchanged by their defense. First, do you agree with that?
No, I don't. And I don't really want to talk about Bill Kunstler because I don't have a whole lot of good things to say about him. But no.
Okay. So in any case, there are omniferous components. Why were these men convicted to a sentence of 240-year prison term?
Well, predominantly because there's a number of lives that were lost in the bombing itself. The judge saw it appropriate to sentence them consecutively, which in the aggregate amounted to 200 and some years. So the judge wanted to give them a sentence on each person that died as a result of the bombing.
Okay. And that gives us some clarity on that. What motivated you to attend law school?
Just growing up, my mom and dad, I was different as a child in some respects. I never got to watch cartoons and play those kind of games. My parents had me a doctor's kit, and my mother had her own personal attorney, and so she would take me to her attorney's office at least once a month, and I would just play in his office because my parents drilled in my head that I had to be a professional, I had to be independent and work for myself. And they wanted me to be either a doctor or a lawyer. And as I got older, I chose to be a lawyer.
Did you ever anticipate that you would be the kind of lawyer you are today? And let me just pause here for a minute. The contributing questions are created by Jalil Muhammad. He is currently a law student at Columbia University. He was not able to be on with us today, but decided to contribute some questions, and we certainly appreciate his time and effort as he is engrossed in his studies today. So going back to my question, did you ever anticipate that you would be this kind of lawyer today? And what would your younger self or neophyte to the profession?
Well, I mean, I wanted to become a lawyer, and I wanted to become proficient and great at what I was going to do. I always felt that I had the ability to contribute to society, and my motivation wasn't an economic motivation. My motivation was to be able to protect and safeguard the constitutional rights of people who grew up in areas like me. I don't have the typical story. I wasn't a poor boy who grew up in a broken home and all that. I was pretty much an only child. I pretty much had all the material things that I had. But like many people in that economic range, you know, I was in the streets, not selling drugs and stuff, but I was in the streets at a young age, and I saw a lot at a young age. And as, you know, by the time other people got in the streets, I had already decided that I wanted to do certain things with my life. So I was inside. I came inside while other people was going out on the streets. And because I was a prolific, basically like a child prodigy in sports when I grew up, in those days, the older guys used to protect you. But primarily, I saw a lot of people who I grew up with go in and out of the system as juveniles and as adults. And I felt that if I had an opportunity to become an attorney, that one day I may be in a position to help.
Give me an example of one of your most prolific cases, in your opinion, and how that challenged you.
I mean, anytime you're entrusted with someone's freedom, it's always a challenge because most of the time, the type of client I get is not the type of client who could afford to hire their own expert or to actually have witnesses come on the stand and testify. So I would say I don't want to identify any particular case. I think every client's case is important, and I deal with every case individually, and I try to give all my clients the same amount of focus and attention. So for me, every case is challenging because you never know the outcome, and a lot depends on whether a person is going to go to trial or accept a plea offer as a disposition.
how do you determine what case you'll take?
Sometimes it depends on when I meet with the person or the family, the type of vibe I get from them. Sometimes it depends on the client himself. I have a rule that I don't represent anybody who's disrespectful to their mother. When I see a person that's disrespectful to the mother, because you have to understand, most of my clients, their mothers are the ones who foot the bill, who come into my office and who cry and who don't understand why their son or daughter is in that situation, because they feel like they've done everything to have their to influence their children to take a different course in life. So if I see a young man who's disrespectful to his mother, I don't have any respect for him, and I won't take that person's case.
You know, that's a beautiful point. As an educator in the school system, often the parents, the mother, it would be a single mother, coming in to have a discussion, a parent meeting with that student, or the parents were obsolete and it was a grandmother. And I recall telling my students, if you disrespect your mother or your grandmother, we're not going further with this discussion until you apologize to them in front of me. So that is very, very prolific of what you just stated. A case where, and give me, just give me a generic percentage of cases, and not necessarily your cases, but cases in this system that are against the innocent. If we could take a few minutes and talk about that, please.
Every case in the system is against the innocent, because a person is presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And I guess if you were to go in every prison in the United States and ask, tell them to raise their hand if they committed a crime, no hands would go up. Nobody believes that they're guilty. There's always some justification, at least in most people's minds, for the conduct that they engage themselves in. There are cases when it's clear that there could be a misidentification, or there is justification for the conduct of a person now charged with a crime. It's really apparent, especially in today's society, because they use a lot of video, electronic surveillance, and which supplements the state's case. So in a lot of cases, it's pretty apparent. And then I call it the Sammy the Bull syndrome. If you recall, Sammy the Bull was a hitman for John Gotti. And what happened was they plastered Sammy the Bull all over every newspaper when he became a government informant. And at the time, me and one of my other colleagues, the Honorable Judge Bahia Kamil, were talking, and we both started laughing, and we said, hey, this is going to give a license to all these little gangsters to start telling. Give a license to all these so-called gangsters to start telling on each other. So now we live in a society where that is like priority for 67-70% of these guys. They like to go in and give a statement. And once you go in and give a statement, you locked yourself in because you don't understand the law. So most of the time you either locked yourself in as a principal in the crime or an accomplice in the crime. And once you do that, then it makes the odds very difficult to overcome.
Is the justice system fair?
I mean, there are some inequities in the system. I think when you talk about whether it's fair or not, it depends on what stage you're at. The biggest tool a prosecutor has is his discretion when it comes to what we call plea bargaining. Sometimes plea bargaining can be unfair because you'll see different results for different people. But
take your time.
But in my estimation, I tend to think that the juries at least 75-80% of the time, they get it right. You know, our jury system, I think, is one of the best ways of making a determination. Now, I'm not saying the juries always get it right, and I'm not saying that they made decisions sometimes I was a little baffled by or couldn't understand, but generally speaking, I would think our jury system is pretty much fair and impartial. I don't think, let me just finish this thought. The system that we have is fair. The persons who administrate the systems may be biased, may have their own partialities, may have their own preferences. And when you see injustice or the misapplication of the law, it comes from the people who administrate the system more than it comes from the system itself. There are mechanisms in place in this system to right the wrongs. That's why when a person gets convicted of a crime, they always have a right to appeal, automatic right to appeal, where you have an appellate division who not only reviews how the trial went, but they review how the law was applied. They review how the attorneys conducted themselves. That's the prosecutor and defense attorney. A common basis for appeal is always anytime someone loses, they file what they call ineffective assistance of counsel, okay? Because most people believe that ineffective assistance of counsel means my lawyer wasn't good because I lost, but that's not what it legally means. It means that your lawyer performed in a way that's consistent with professional standards in the profession, okay? Meaning, did he make the proper objections? Did he raise the proper issues? Did he present all the evidence that was available to him? And if he didn't, why not? So the analysis is different. So because of the checks and balances in the system, I say the system could work. Now, sometimes when you have people who administrate over the system, if they're unfair or they're partial, then that's when you can see sometimes the miscarriage of justice. But generally speaking, I think the system is fair.
I wish I would have known what when I first began law.
I wish I would have listened to my father.
And he said what?
Well, I mean, there's the law, and then there's the business of law. The law is constant, but the business of law changes. And what do I mean by that? I mean, it's your clientele. You get people like, oh, everybody that I know, they say, oh, you should be the richest person around here, blah, blah, blah. But I don't charge the type of fees that other attorneys charge because, like I said, I didn't come into the profession to get rich. However, what I find, and when I speak to most people who look like me, what we find is that when people come to us, they expect that we're going to take less. And even when we take less, they want to bargain in terms of how they pay us. My father once told me, he said, if you're going to open your own law practice, and this might sound a little racist, but he said, go get you a young woman, blonde hair, blue eyes. Let her be at your desk as your receptionist and get you some Caucasians. Let them walk around your office so when people come in, they think you just work for the Caucasians. And then you'll make all the money in the world because as soon as they realize that you're the head of everything, they're going to want to bargain with you.
And you're definitely speaking of the business of the law.
The business of the law, yes.
Very much so. In our culture, in our society. You know, here's my thing, and I tend to agree with you that the judicial system can work itself. However, when it comes to, you know, I met a young woman, dynamic attorney out of Chicago, and she said this to me. She said, there's such a large percentage of young black males in the system.
I'm going to have to
on inconclusive evidence. And because they cannot afford to prove their disposition, they wind up with sentencing beyond what they should be sentenced. Can you speak to this a minute, please?
Well, I mean, what we're talking about is, remember, are we talking about the criminal justice system as a whole or the judicial system? Because there's a distinct difference. From a criminal aspect, all cases start from the police department or from civilians coming in filing complaints against other people. So a lot of times where you see the injustice is where you have arrest of people who clearly, for example, I'll give you a hypothetical. If the police in the 80s when they had the war on drugs, police would come up to a corner and they call stash pads, right? And they would find drugs in the area. And if nobody said, well, those drugs are mine, then everybody got arrested. And what that did is placed a burden on everybody arrested to either say whose drugs they were or go to trial and prove it wasn't their drugs. So in that respect, the application and the implementation and the enforcement was unfair, okay? Because what happens is you would have a lot of people in the system who may not have, should have been there, okay? So eventually some of them were exonerated or people would take the weight. Now, police officers would say, well, then all somebody had to do was come forward and say, well, there, we wouldn't arrest everybody. That may or may not be true, but the general practice of the police department was you arrest everybody. The same thing with if it was a motor vehicle stop and it's a gun in the car. If the gun is in the glove compartment or secreted in under a seat or something and nobody takes the weight, then everybody gets arrested. The theory is if you don't arrest everybody, then what happens is the person who gets charged, he says, I didn't know a gun was in the car. The guy in the back seat put it in the car. And since they only have to prove guilt, since they have the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, then the case walks away. So a lot of times it has to do, your problems start at the law enforcement level.
Very good, very good. Absolutely. Listen, you mitigate murder and double murder cases. And then I look here and I see you're a solo practitioner. How in the world do you do this all?
Well, okay. People ask that question. And I always say people don't like lawyers till they need one. People don't like lawyers till they need one. What we do as lawyers, yes, we defend the person. But what we also do is we defend the rights that are afforded to every American citizen under the Constitution. This is our way. This is why they call it checks and balances. Because this is our way to make sure that the government or the local attorney or the attorney general's office or the prosecutor stay true to their responsibility, okay, of not violating the rights of citizens. So, you know, no matter, it's all crime. It's just a degree, it's the degrees of the crime. But it's all crime. It really doesn't make a difference. Now, it may make difference to the families, I accept that. Because clearly, if your family member is murdered,
after the
it's different.
Their right, then turn right onto Route 166.
If your family member is murdered, it's clearly different than if you got somebody get arrested for drugs. But the defendant themselves is not that much of a difference. Why? Because the end result is they lose their liberty. So
right onto Route 166, Main Street.
That's how I would address it.
I understand you're very persuasive in the courtroom. And those closing arguments are imperative to the case and very striking to the jury. Explain how important that is and why it's important to be strategic in that process.
Well, we call the closing arguments or referred to as summations. They're important because that's an attorney's overall synopsis or view of, in terms of the defense, what we talk about is, one, the state has the burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that burden is based on what we call the elements of the offense. And if we believe during the course of the trial that the state has failed to prove one of the elements, then we talk about what element they failed to prove. Or it could be a combination of a failure to prove. It could be a combination of a failure to prove the elements versus if you have, say, a material witness or a person that's a key witness in the case, and there's an issue regarding that person's credibility, okay, whether that person gave prior inconsistent statements or whether that person wasn't in a position to perceive the things that they perceived, or, you know, that person has a prior criminal history that would make their veracity subject to acceptance, then you talk about all of that. You talk about the what we call the totality of the circumstances. You talk about the perspective of the state, what the state hopes that you would find and hope you will find credible. And then you talk about why it isn't credible and what you would hope the jury would find. Because what happens is you only have to convince one person to acquit.
Onto Old Freehold Road, County Route 623.
We only need one person. If we get one person, we could either have a hung jury. If we get more than one person, then you could just flip
for 1 mile, then you will arrive at your destination on the right.
I'll be at my destination in 1 minute, so I'm sorry. But if you could flip a whole jury, then because in the summation, the judge says a couple of things, one of which is the attorney's summation is not evidence. And I usually say, although my summation is not evidence, if you find that anything I've said is consistent with the evidence that was presented to you, then you can use that. If you find it's inconsistent, you throw it away. Simple as that. You know, but it's either 12 people, at least in New Jersey, either 12 people have to agree or 12 people have to disagree. And since you can target one person, it depends on the type of case you have. There are cases when I know, listen, I got to just get one person because I know I'm not flipping everybody, okay?
Ooh.
And
mm-hmm.
if I felt either through body language or eye contact that there was a person on that jury who I believe is receptive to my position in the case, then I would tailor my summation in some respects to that individual, to tell that individual to maintain their independence, to be strong, don't let people bully them, you know, hold your ground, be like Abraham. Be like Abraham, you know, when Abraham wouldn't change his monotheism to become a mushrik, you know, that kind of thing.
And I understand in the courtroom you're that way.
Well,
sometimes
you do.
Sometimes the judges say, Mr. Abdallah, you know, like you may touch a client and the judge will get upset. How do you handle all of that?
I mean, when people are on trial, they become, you know, you have a whole trial where people are talking about two people. Like, say a homicide, you're talking about the decedent and you're talking about the defendant. And the thing about it is with the decedent, You have some family members and other people there so that the jury could get a visual for the person.
Yes.
Whereas with the defendant, there are times when nobody's in the courtroom with the defendant. So it becomes very impersonal. So I try to make it so that people understand.
I will provide additional guidance after you've completed your call.
So that people understand that this person is also a person.
Yes,
you know?
Very much so.
Yeah, and so that the person is not, like, just ignored. I mean, even though the prosecutor is painting the person in one light, I try to do it in a way that at least gives some humanity to the guy sitting next to me.
Yes, sir. Very important. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent. Rod Speaks. Dr. Muhammad, did you want to interject here?
Yes, I had a couple of questions that I wanted to raise. So one question that I wanted to raise was that you had mentioned earlier in your interview that your parents played a proactive and instrumental role in your development and becoming an attorney.
Yes.
Do you think that if you didn't have the support from your parents, your outcome would have been different, like due to your environment, just in general?
Well, I'm going to answer that two ways, okay?
Okay.
The first way would be from a secular position. I was never a follower. My parents didn't raise me to be a follower. My community was a combination of middle class, but I always say that down the street from my house was the first New Jack City. We had a family that lived down the street from us that owned a big multi-complex apartment building. And all they did was sell drugs throughout the whole building. And I actually used to play in that building with some of the family members of the drug dealers.
Mm.
So, I mean, you could easily be influenced by that. And then I had relatives who, you know, was in the streets. But I guess I could have been influenced by that. But then from a spiritual aspect, Allah says everybody has a qadha. So not that I believe in predestination, but listen, I know that if it was not for the grace of Allah, I could be like the people that I prosecute. It's funny because when I first started as a prosecutor, our office was right across from the jail. And in the springtime, when the jail windows were open, the guys would be looking out the window, and they would be called, "Yo, Hassan, what's up, man? This is so-and-so, this is so-and-so." So when I first started working, and they would be calling me from the window, the Caucasians would be looking at me like, "What? Who is this guy?" Everybody called from the jail, you know. And one time a Caucasian person said to me, like, "Why are all these guys in the jail calling you?" I said, "Because I grew up with them." Because I grew up with them. I know them. You know, the only difference between me and them is they're in there and I'm out here. You know? And yes, I could say that I made decisions that kept me out of that, but I also made decisions that could have put me in it.
Right.
So, you know, I never take it like as if like I have like, you know, I'm some prize that, you know, I just look at it as the mercy of Allah. That's the only way I could answer.
Right. No, that's a good way of answering that question. So in addition to that question, now there are quite a few, you know, people, individuals, males especially, who don't have role models that they look up to. I mean, there are plenty that are out there. But there are children who want to go to college, who don't have the resources, who want to become attorneys, who don't have the family support. Do you know of any type of program that will provide opportunities for academic development for young individuals who could serve as mentors in the law profession arena that could reach back out to the community? I mean, because influences, they're everywhere, right? They're pervasive. But for those who do not have family support, and I've come across a lot of individuals who do not have that, can you offer any type of resources that you could kind of mention here on the show that can help propel other individuals to pursue a career in law?
Well, the first resource is yourself.
I like that.
You have to be confident and committed to what you want to do. When I was in law school, a lot of the guys that I grew up with didn't believe I was in law school. And I'll never forget, I was playing basketball one day, and a guy who I was a competitor with said to me, "You ain't going to be S-H-I-T, you know, and he went into this whole thing about what I wasn't going to do. And now I'm in my second year of law school. And I just looked at him and laughed. When I got accepted to Bucknell University, I got accepted academically. Then they found out I was a football player, and I wound up getting a full scholarship. But when I went to my guidance counselor, who was a Caucasian, and I started asking him about the school, he said to me, "Why do you want to go there? You'll never get in that school." I said, "What do you mean I'll never get in that school?" He said, "No, you'd never get in that school." Now, I graduated number 21 in my class. He told me I would never get in that school. So I said, I won't say his name. I said to him, I've already been accepted. I said, matter of fact, when I get my diploma, I'm going to come back and give it to you. And I say all that to say that, you know, you have to rely on your own perseverance first. And you have to be committed, because what happens is when you're committed and people see you committed, they come out the woodworks. I remember when I used to go to law school, my father died my first year of law school, my first time, my first year of exams, my father died. So the next year, I used to walk almost a mile to get to the train station to go to school. It was a brother in the neighborhood who knew the bus driver, who knew I went to school, was very close with me. He went to the bus driver and told the bus driver anytime he saw me to ride me, give me a ride on the bus for free.
Wow.
Then there was another gentleman, may God rest his soul. He saw me one day. I was just getting to know him. He used to own a restaurant. And he saw me one day, and he said, yo, Muslim, you got that look on your face. I said, what's that? I never said anything to him. He said, you got that look like you're questioning whether you should be doing this or not, Muslim. Don't question it. Allah got you. Don't worry about it. And, like, it came out of nowhere.
Powerful.
You know? So then every day when I would come home, he would be waiting for me. Give me some coffee. Give me, you know, whatever. And I say all that to say is that you will be surprised the resources available that Allah will make available to you when you commit to yourself to doing what's right. You know, doing what's right is a struggle. And the problem with this young generation, everything comes overnight, like instant coffee. I always say it's like watching the movie Exodus. You know, Moses crosses the Red Sea in 2 hours. But a miracle, like I look at myself as a miracle, but it didn't take 2 hours. It didn't take 2 hours. So you have to, you know, you have to believe in yourself, not with arrogance, but with confidence. And you have to be determined to make it. And when, you know, you can't appreciate something until you have, Allah says, after the adversity come what? The ease.
Peace. That's right.
Peace. So if you don't have, you don't appreciate things when they're too easy. You
take
it for granted. But when you have to work to get to a certain level, you have more of an appreciation. And also, in that adversity, like they say, adversity builds character.
That's right.
Because in adversity, you can learn so much more. When everything is going great, there's nothing to learn.
That's right. That is so true.
Yes,
education comes from challenges,
desire, and things like that. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, you have to learn how to read and write. You have to learn how to pray.
Right. And it's very poignant that you mentioned there's always the unseen community that jumps in and assists. So that's interesting.
Because
you
got a lot of people out there looking for people to help, but they don't want to. And then you got a lot of people out there that's BSing like they need help.
They're gaming, brother.
You know. And, Hassan, what distinguishes, let me just pause here, what distinguishes, if anything, because you're touching on this as you speak, so I want to ask you this specifically. What distinguishes, if anything, a Muslim attorney from a non-Muslim attorney?
Good point.
One would be your name. And then, I guess, now I'm not saying non-Muslim attorneys don't have a moral compass, but like as a Muslim, there's certain things I'm not going to do because everything ain't about winning. Everything ain't about winning. And also, I want a certain type of reputation. I want to be able to call a judge and tell a judge something, and he could bank on it. When I call a judge, he knows if I tell him X, he knows I'm not BSing. Like I had a judge said to me one time, he called me to sidebar. He said, listen, Hassan, if you got a program for this person in your community, I'm going to give you 2 weeks. Find a program. I'll send that person to that program. Mm-hmm. So even in the judicial system, it's about credibility. If judges don't believe in your credibility, you're not going very far. Because one of the main ethics canons is honesty. Like, people think that lawyers could just lie, but it's not like that. There's a whole lot of checks and balances on lawyers. So, you know, that's what I would say. I mean, I don't really – everybody – it's what – you know, I don't even think about – think it's about Muslim versus non-Muslim. Most of it is about your moral compass, how were you raised, your character. What's important to you? You know, if you offered me $1 million but I had to compromise my character, then it might be an issue. You know, we know, like, if we look at the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in Hudaybiyah, he would not write Muhammad Rasulullah. And the Sahaba got upset with him. But he was able to see the bigger goal. What was the bigger goal? To stop fighting the Quraysh. To get back into Mecca. So one of the things that happens as a Muslim, we have so many examples of how to make good decisions, how to use proper judgment. Because if you're a Muslim, like, it's difficult for a person to tell me they're a Muslim and they can't read, because they're telling me during Ramadan you're not reading the Quran.
Come on now.
Because there's no reason that a Muslim should be illiterate.
Right.
Just as a general, see, Islam is a practical aspect of life. There's nothing in Islam that you shouldn't be able to use in your life. So if you're a Muslim and you can't read, that tells me that when Ramadan comes, you're not reading. Because even if you only read two surahs, you would still be reading. And you would be able to read. You would be literate.
That's right.
But remember, our prophet was illiterate. See, that's another example of the Quran. Allah revealed the Quran to the prophet Muhammad, who was illiterate, but it made the rest of the world literate. That's that condition on Ramadan where you pray and you read.
Yes, sir. Yes,
you know, I've been talking to non-Muslims, particularly people who call themselves Christians, and they tell me how now they read the Bible every day, you know, because they know, like, it's a race with the Muslim, but they can never catch up with us because what we do is so natural.
It's a way of life, right?
It's a way of life.
That's right.
And plus, it's incumbent on us at least once a year. Things are just, you know, like, to me, are just common sense.
Beautiful points. Thank you so much. What are your thoughts on the national movement to reform bail?
Well, there's some very good aspects of it, and there's also some very challenging aspects. Let me just say this. In New Jersey, we have bail reform. And the bail reform was pushed through under Governor Christie, and a lot of the ministers were involved in that. So when it went through, a minister said to me with his chest out, I said, how you like what we did? And I said to him, you guys should have stayed in your pew.
Ooh.
He said, what do you mean by that? I said, because you took upon the task, and you never asked the soldiers on the ground about it. Because what happens is, to me, it's nothing but preventive detention. Now, there are a lot of times where the courts get it right. But as I always say, what do you do with guys with domestic violence? And I know that's a testy subject because nobody advocates a woman being beaten or, in some cases, a man being beaten. However, like, I've had the experience where I had a person, early 50s, owned two homes, never been in trouble before, scored a 1-1 because they do what they call a PSA, public service assessment, and they score you. Mm-hmm. One is the lowest you could be. And they kept them. Why? Because of the politics of it. People are so afraid of releasing people charged with domestic violence, because in some cases people have gotten out and committed serious crimes against the victims of domestic violence. And I understand that. But what happens when a person is a 1-1 and you don't let them out, then what's the purpose of bail reform?
Mm-hmm.
And also, in my particular case, the guy almost lost everything. Because when you're in jail, you can't pay no mortgages, you can't work. So he was forced to take a plea so he'd get out of jail and salvage his life.
Excellent point. Now,
there are cases where the judges are definitely making the right decision, because some of these people, they need to keep them in. Okay? And I say that even as a defense attorney. There's some things when, some crimes when you commit, yeah, you should be remanded. However, we didn't have to have a amendment to the Constitution. All we had to do was change the bail guidelines. If you don't want people who get charged with crimes where there's a presumption of non-incarceration, what we call third and fourth degree crimes in New Jersey, then just reduce the amount of money they got to put up. Because allegedly the intention was to protect people who were in on low-level crimes who sat because they didn't have any money. So you just reduced the bail guidelines for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. That was that simple. Under the new legislation, everybody goes to jail for 24 to 48 hours.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, whether or not people are getting out and committing subsequent crimes and all that, I haven't seen enough studies to be able to say that's true or false. I have had a couple of clients who got out and allegedly committed crimes after they got out. Not many, maybe one or two, but majority of the people that I've represented haven't been people convicted, charged with an allegation of committing subsequent crimes while monitoring. And the other part of it is, like, when you are monitoring, there's different levels, right? So the more serious nature of the crime, the level is normally almost like in-house arrest.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens with that is the person don't have the ability to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you're taking away the limited resources that they had, that they had already.
Poignantly put, because my next question to you, what are some of the conditions of recidivism? And you're talking about it right now.
Yeah. I don't know necessarily, well, I guess limited resources are some of the conditions that contribute to recidivism. But I think that, like in a lot of cases, should that has developed, where going to prison is more important than going to college, where you all have no stain unless you've been to prison, where the people who have influence in the community are people who've gone to jail. And a lot of that is because the people who are professionals, we don't come back to the community. We go to the suburbs. So the only thing you have left in the community is the same thing you got in jail. Other people who've been to jail, with the few people who haven't, but who are being trained to go to jail.
Yes.
Because, see, these young boys are learning how to go to prison in the community. Because when these people are released, they're coming back to the community. They're telling all these war stories about when they're in jail. They're dramatizing it. Then we watch TV. You watch Goodfellas, you watch The Sopranos, where crime is glamorized, right?
Mm-hmm.
So everybody want to be a gangster. Rappers talk about they got their Glock, they got their 9, you know, bling bling. So it's hard to convince a young person that it's better to make a sacrifice 5 or 6, 7, 8 years and not go to prison than it is to go out, hang on the corner all day or do whatever you're doing with the fear of the police kicking in your door or the competition killing you. They'd rather do that because they think they could survive that. Because they got enough examples of people who survived that. Because even getting shot now is a symbol of your manhood. Oh, yeah, he shot me 5 times. And I'm still alive. Mm-hmm. So people want to feel like they're invincible.
What are your thoughts on, and we're talking about progressive prosecutors now, what are your thoughts on, I'll just give a few examples, Eric Gonzalez in Brooklyn, Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore. What are your thoughts on progressive prosecutors? And is there such a thing that really exists?
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about people and what they're trying to do. I've read some things, but I don't give a lot of credence to what I read because people write what they feel is appropriate for whatever the moment is and their political position. I think that what happens is that when you become the prosecutor, you have the pressure of fighting crime versus justice because they're different. When I was a prosecutor, I used to say to people all the time, people who live in neighborhoods have the same right to tranquility as you do as a drug dealer to your sales. Because there is a dichotomy that's hard to deal with. Like, how do you protect, like, your dilemma, especially if you're of color, your dilemma is that on one hand, you want to protect the people in the community, but you just get so tired of seeing people who look like you constantly going through the system.
Ooh.
But what happens also is we live on the East Coast. So when you live on the East Coast, you tend to see more people who look like us going to jail. And I'm not saying that this is not true every place in the country, but you got other parts of the country where there's a lot of people who look like them going to jail. Okay? But, you know, being progressive, I don't know what that means, is because if you want to relax, like, for example, if you want to relax the type of plea offers you give, okay, in this case, we used to give a plea offer of 5 with 85, meaning 5 years under NERA, which is no early release, with 85. We're not going to do that anymore. What we're going to do, we're going to offer 3 years with 85. And that's kind of progressive, is less time. And I'm speaking predominantly about New Jersey because I don't practice anyplace else. Now the big thing is drug court. There's two big things, drug court and mental health court. And I think this is a way for the legislature to try to divert people. I think the mental health court wasn't primarily designed for people of color. But I think that so many Caucasians start getting caught up in this system, you know, they designed a mental health court. And the drug court, same thing. You know, it was one thing when people, like it was crack when people of color was getting arrested, okay? Mm-hmm. And it was a public health issue. I mean, it was a big crime. But with the opioids, where most Caucasians was caught up into, it became a public health issue.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
So it's all about how you label it. Because it's very
interesting.
If you look at the label, you know how it's going to be attacked. One, if you say it's public health, you're going to get more compassion. Because you're basically saying this person got a health issue that we need to help them with. But if it's an epidemic, a crack epidemic, that means we got to do something to curb this. We got to lock everybody up.
Yes, yes, yes.
The language.
Yes.
Yes.
Interesting.
But conversely, I once did a lecture. I got a award or something, and it was when I was in the prosecutor's office. And a few people got upset with me because I said, you know, they were complaining about what was going on, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, why don't you help the police? They said, what do you mean by that? I said, just go home and turn in a drug deal in your house.
Oh, my God. Keeping it
100%. There are solutions. There are solutions to this, but we don't want to face the reality also. Now, I'm not saying all black people are drug dealers. I'm not saying all black people got drug dealers in the house. But those who do, they know who they are.
Yes, yes, yes. It's very important.
Yeah, and what happens is sometimes the people, the families themselves, low income, don't have any money or anything. And the mothers are caught up into having to choose between taking the money for the material stuff or just living below poverty guidelines. Like, it's no simple solution to it. But I will say this. Part of the problem is people are willing to go for the quick fix because a lot of people believe that it's worth doing 5 or 10 years in jail if they can make $1 million selling drugs.
Wow. Listen, let's talk about one other cultural, let me just pause here, one other cultural phenomenon that's occurring, and if you can, just your thoughts on this, you know, would be so much appreciated, about suicide now becoming, or suicide ideation becoming the second highest cause of death among African Americans. If you can speak to that for a moment.
Well, that's really complicated. I don't know. I mean, when I was young, coming up, that was a taboo. And everybody said it was a taboo. And you would find nobody encouraged it, at least to my knowledge. I knew very few people who killed themselves. I think I might know one. But that's integrated with what they call mental health. Because right now, everything that happens, like, it's a mental health issue. Mental health issue. And I don't know if it's because we've become as a society weaker in this respect. When I was a little boy, my mother used to throw milk bottles at me from the top of the stairs.
Yes.
She would be in prison now for child abuse. Like, we're not raising, and I'm not an advocate for abuse, being an abusive parent, but part of the issue is if you can't discipline your children when they're young, what do you expect when they get old? I mean, like, if you can't, if it's anything goes and you can't do anything to check them, because to me, how we raise people of color versus how Caucasians raise their children, I don't know if it's cultural. I don't know what it is. But we got to put a hand on these young boys.
Yes.
When you have a son, you got to put a hand on him. You got to have him fear. See, right now we raised in a society that don't have no fear of anything. When we was coming up, we not only feared our parents, we feared the neighbor. Not in fear like, you know, where you trembling, but like you didn't want people, like it was a sense of shame. You didn't want people seeing you doing certain things.
Right.
We had pride in our family name.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? We don't have, like, the dignity of the household is not there anymore. What your name means is not there anymore. And I know a lot of people say, well, let's say my name anyway. Well, good. Then get a name that is yours, but you still got to protect that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have any dignity about how we want to conduct ourselves. Like, it ain't no shame. Like, to me, a perfect example is if you're a grown man and you could walk around with your pants hanging below your cheekbones, like, really? Ain't no pride, no dignity.
No filter.
Yeah, like, I mean, but this is what the youth see. And then with the drain of males in the community, because you got, like I always say, a lot of women don't like this. You can't raise a son, you can't raise a man.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how hard you try, you can't, because a woman's natural tendency for compassion and love and all of that, what happens is you raise your son as if he's a pimp. What do I mean by that? You give him everything he wants. He's 3 years old. He got gold diamonds in his ear. For what? What do you need that for? You know, you give him all the material things you could give him, but he hasn't earned anything. Like,
true.
Yeah. And sometimes when they're young, you have to let them make mistakes. What do I mean by that? Sometimes you got to let them use their own judgment so they can learn how to make choices. Because if you're making all the decisions for your sons, somebody else going to lead them. Because that's all they know.
Amen. I have two sons, and I'm bearing witness to what you're saying. You have to make
them
make decisions.
Yeah.
They fall, they'll figure out how to get back up.
I'm sorry?
I said they fall, they will figure out how to get back up.
Right. You don't want them to make decisions that's going to hurt them for the rest of their life. But little certain decisions, you got to let them make it and see the consequences so they have experience at making decisions.
Hmm.
Let's close with this. I promised you 1 hour, and we're at that mark. So let's close with this. Hassan, in what way, on a state and federal level, with regard to the law, changes that have positively impacted criminal defense?
Well, I don't know if I can point out many, but I think what more than laws, I think it's consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more consciousness. I think what George Floyd did was bring about Allah. You see, Allah can take a gnat and change the world.
Mm.
You know, because people think the only way he's going to change the world is with a Muslim. Allah changed the world with whatever person or thing he chooses.
Right. That's right. Because
Allah is the omnipotent. And I think with George Floyd, what happened is for a lot of people of color and Caucasians, it changed the consciousness of the condition criminal justice system has on communities. And you can say, well, what difference do consciousness is probably a more powerful tool than anything else. Because until you change people's hearts, you can't change anything. You can't legislate away racism. You can't legislate away partiality. You can't legislate away bias. But when a person becomes more conscious of their deeds and their conduct, then you got a greater opportunity. And I think what George Floyd did is And I don't want to forget Breonna Taylor, all that whole little sequence of things that happened that brought people in the streets and everything. I think what happened is it made people more conscious, you know. Even though some may say it was just a microcosm of the system, it was a big microcosm. It had a hell of an impact.
Yes.
And I think in that respect, it made legislators, judges, prosecutors, and everyone else not only take a deep look at themselves, but take a deep look at what they preside over and how they're implementing it. And to me, that's more impactful than whatever legislation you could write up.
Wow.
Because if you're more conscious, that means some things you don't have to enforce. Where you got discretion, like you say, well, why am I gonna do that?
Wow. Very powerful.
Yes.
Dr. Muhammad, your final thoughts.
Just thank you so much for coming on the show today and imparting the knowledge that you have and your life experiences. Just, we really appreciate it. We pray to Allah that he continues to bless you in the area of law and to serve our people and the people of all backgrounds, classes, and creed. Thank you, brother. May Allah continue to bless you.
Thank you for the opportunity. You know, I hope that your show continues to be successful as it is. And if you need me sometime down the road, I'll be available to you. And a special thanks to my dear and close brother, Muhammad.
Yes, sir. It has been an honor and a pleasure to have the renowned Hassan Abdallah with us today. Is there any contact information, like an email, something that anybody can reach out to you with?
I mean, my email address is myfirstname_mylastname@hotmail.com. And I would also just say this. If you haven't, pick up that Quran and read it.
Hmm.
You know, because in
that's
it,
right.
Allah says, "Dali kal kitabu labreba fi hudal mutakim." This is the book wherein no doubt, a sure guidance, and just read it with an open heart.
Let
that's
me,
what I would say.
That's Thank you
powerful.
So much, sir. Let me just do this for the audience. So that email is Hassan, H-A-S-S-E-N, underscore, Abdullah, A-B-D-E-L-L-A-H, and that's at?
Hotmail.com.
At hotmail.com. Thank you, sir.
Yes.
It
thank
has
you.
Been an honor. Thank you. Please do come back.
And I'm sorry about the GPS interruptions.
Listen, I know your time is sacred, and I'm just so happy that you were able to join us today.
Okay.
It has been a true blessing.
Directions will resume automatically when you
have a good day.
This program is sponsored by New Africa Ethnologies. Thank you for joining us today. Dr. Muhammad, your email information, if anybody wants to contact you.
Yes, my email information is my first name, Nadia, N-A-D-I-A, last name Muhammad, M-U-H-A-M-M-A-D, 12, that's the number 12, at yahoo.com.
Excellent. And I may be reached at S-A-L-I-M-A-H, first name, M-O-H, 77, at gmail.com. Again, to the listening audience, thank you for joining us today. And assalamu alaikum. Enjoy the rest of your Saturday.
Assalamu alaikum.